bigger than the man. It was a song about justice asking, won't you take a stand? It was a song about a song to sing all over this land.
Well, welcome back, everybody, to a very special Vox Pop. I'm Alan Chartok here with Joe Donahue and David Gustina. Folk music legend, civil rights activist, and great friend of WAMC, Pete Seeger, has died at the age of 94. The Beacon, New York native roamed the American landscape for over 50 years with a five-string banjo around his neck, singing songs of peace and protest. He formed the popular group The Weavers, of course. In the late 1940s, they were named as Communist Party sympathizers in 1952 and were blacklisted from the entertainment industry. 10 years later, he was convicted of contempt of Congress, but was acquitted and went on to keep making music that defined much of the civil rights movement. He's known for songs like If I Had a Hammer, Goodnight Irene, We Shall Overcome, as well as our catchy media project theme, Newspapermen Meet Such Interesting People. He didn't write it. Vern Partlidge did.
That's right.
But he sort of sang it and popularized it, among so many others. He's been honored by the Kennedy Center. He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But he was a guy, and I know this well when I talked to him about it, who eschewed honors. Didn't want to be honored. I asked him once why he took the Kennedy honors, and he said his family sort of pushed him into it. But otherwise, you know, he could have had every single college in America, or most of them, would have given him an honorary degree. He performed almost to his dying day, recently surprising audience with an impromptu performance at Farm Aid in Saratoga, as well as putting on a concert for WAMC members this past September in Peekskill. To his wonderful family, who have had double loss this year, we wish good things and peace. What do you remember most about him? Give us a call, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also get in touch with us online and see all the ways that we do things at, or just write us at wamc.org/voxpop. Okay, so we have a very special guest now, Paul Stuckey. Noel, of course, Paul Stuckey, joins us with his recollections of Pete. Noel is a singer-songwriter activist most famous for his part of the legendary folk trio Peter, Paul, and Mary. He's the Paul. Thanks so much for joining us. We're so happy you're with us, and you're so decent to give up your time. I know that the song you just sang is heartfelt, and we all feel the same way. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks so much. I feel like we're all standing around in a virtual circle. You know, Pete was not real long on technology. I think he thought it was one of the great threats to humanity. And he could handle it as long as humanity was uppermost. And yet, if it weren't for that, we wouldn't be commiserating together in this virtual living room, you know, where I'm sure you're going to get a lot of calls today. And I think Peter's going to check in around 2 o'clock as we try to figure out how the world will go on without the pillar holding up the corner of folk music porch, you know.
Well,
I think it's going to be an ongoing inspiration, you know, that Pete left. I wrote just recently that, you know, Pete was not about who he was. It was about what he left us, you know.
And Noel, when did you first meet him?
Oh, well, you know, during the civil rights movement, there was a exchange and interactivity among everybody who was part of that family. I'm sure you've heard the Bill Kaufman expression, the heart is a little to the left.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The fact is that all of the lefties and progressives were there for the civil rights movement and then matriculated into, you know, a concern about the war in Vietnam. And
sure.
once you've accepted the ethic and the far-sightedness of the communal nature of folk music, there's no looking back, and you're going to stay in that family for a long time. The last visit I had with Pete was probably just a couple of months ago. And if anything, it underlines the fact that you were speaking of, you know, he really avoided publicity. I wrote I was thinking about it today, and I said, Pete lived simply, modestly, and suffered compliments warily.
Absolutely true. Absolutely.
Isn't that true?
Yes.
You say anything that was aggrandizing or, you know, complimentary to Pete, and he didn't even look like he was processing it. He just looked like he couldn't wait to get on to the next thing to talk about. It made it terribly uncomfortable.
You know, Noel, he said something to me once that that really has stayed with me forever. We were talking about him, and I said, but you're Pete. And he said, you know, there are two Petes. There's me, the Pete, and then there's Pete Seeger. And to differentiate, you know, that he was an individual. He's a man of great dignity, I always felt. He wasn't a guy to start slapping anybody on the back and saying, how are you? You know, that kind of stuff. He's a very kind man. From the time I was 16, I was writing him letters, and he was writing back to everybody, you know, so he really cared about people. But it's extraordinary that you say what you say is so true. You know, I wanted to get that bridge over the Hudson named for him, the peace bridge over the Hudson named for him. And everybody was online, Governor Patterson, the Speaker of the Assembly, everybody else. And I heard from his grandson who called me and said, Grandpa says cut it out. So that's just the way the guy is, and has always been. It's great. Well, you took some of his songs.
You know, and I got to tell you this too. I was just talking to somebody a few minutes ago, and you remember the great. I was talking to Max Cleland, as a matter of fact, from Georgia, and we were recounting Pete, and I said, you remember there was a whole raft during the evangelistic. Thrust of the Christian evangelicals in the 70s and the 80s, there was this phrase, what would Jesus do? And I said, you know, now that Pete is gone, I said, it won't be applied the same way. I said, but if you're ever in a political quandary or an ethical quagmire, the perfect thing to ask is, what would Pete do?
And did you employ that yourself?
What's that?
What would Pete do? What would Pete do in certain situations?
I have to beg that the last 40 years of my life have been so influenced by the ethic of folk music that I didn't have to answer. I didn't have to ask that question. Now that we are without him, and we will be placed as you know children are in circumstances that are going to be very challenging, because Pete stood up for ethics. I mean, Pete stood up for the underdog sometimes when you didn't even know. You were standing next to him, you didn't even know there was another dog in the game,
you know?
And Pete would say, no. Huh?
Noel, I hope I'm not being disrespectful, but we've got five regular listeners on the phone who all want to say something about Pete. Do you mind if we go on to them? And we appreciate your call so much, and you're really a decent guy to do it.
Thank you. God bless you.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Okay, and now we are going to go on to Abigail in Kingston. Okay, since everybody wants to have their say, we're going to keep them short. Go ahead, Abigail.
Hi, Alan. So good. So thank you so much. I was lucky enough. Ian told me I would have to wait a while. I said I would wait for a million years for another Pete Seeger. I hope one comes soon. We're all working on the same thing. This is a great opportunity. He was just a great man. I was lucky enough to do the publicity for the Sloop Clearwater's pumpkin sale in 1986. I kind of remember being in the same room with him on many occasions, but I have nothing intimate to tell about him.
Okay, so Abigail, you said something which I found very interesting, and then I'm going to let you go after you answer this question.
Yeah.
Do you think there can be another Pete?
I think it's within all of us to do our best. I think that's what he's telling us.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that we all can rise to occasions for love, for justice, for equality.
Yeah, but that's not what I'm talking about.
Yes, and that's what he would want.
Yeah, no, that is what he would want. But I'm talking about somebody who can basically capture something the way he... Okay.
That is for us to answer.
Okay, Abigail, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Be well. Take care.
Okay, and now we're on to Marge. Okay, Marge in Olive Ridge. Go ahead.
Hi, that's Margie, actually.
Oh, so sorry. I really am.
That is no problem. So I have just a very quick story to tell. I always knew that Pete Seeger was a spectacular human being. I'm growing up. I'm a musician myself. And I got to perform at the Howland Cultural Center in Beacon, New York, one evening, maybe about 6 years ago, and Pete and Toshi came. They were in the audience. It was so beautiful. They held hands. It was really lovely. At the end of the night, when the show was over, you know, everybody was kind of standing around talking. It was a great show. And Pete and Toshi were on their way out the door. And the guy who organized the show, his name was Chris, he just hollered out, "Hey, you know, folks, we could use a little help folding up the chairs and the tables and getting the space ready for tomorrow's event." So Pete was on his way out the door. He turned around, and he came back, and he just started folding up chairs.
That was Pete.
It was so wild. I mean, he had no airs. I mean, at that moment even, I know who this man is.
Yep.
You know, I know who he is, and that's who he was. He was a beautiful man.
Great story, Margie.
So full of love and humility, and I'm so grateful. I say good night, Pete. I'll see you in my dreams.
Okay. Great, Margie. Thanks for that. That was great.
Thank you.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to, first, a very distinguished guest. We're going to be talking to the great Roger McGuinn, another 10 minutes. We'll be talking to him. Right now?
No, he's right now.
Okay, great. Roger, are you there?
Yes, I am.
So tell us what you remember about Pete. What stands out?
Well, I first became aware of Pete around 1957, and I'd been into rockabilly, but I went to high school where the music teacher invited a guy named Bob Gibson, who was influenced by Pete Seeger. He played the 5-string banjo and the 12-string guitar like Pete, and he came and did a set for us at our high school. And I had not heard that kind of music prior to that, so I asked my music teacher what it was, and she steered me over to the Old Town School of Folk Music, where Frank Hamilton, a friend of Pete Seeger's, was a teacher. And he invited Pete over to the school, and I remember Pete coming to the school and borrowing somebody's banjo and playing for us. And I used to go to the Weavers concerts when he was in the Weavers, and when he left the Weavers and became a solo artist, I was so inspired. I wanted to be like that myself. I went, you know, this guy's great. He got the audience singing in three parts, and he played all these different instruments, and he had a wonderful, positive outlook about the world, and it just thrilled me, and it was an inspiration to me, and in fact, has guided me in my life.
How did Turn come to the Birds?
Pardon me?
How did Turn come to you, the song?
Oh. Well, I knew the song Turn, Turn, Turn from watching Pete Seeger do it in concert. And then I was a studio musician in New York City for about 5 years. And Judy Collins was one of the people I played on a session for. And she did the song Turn, Turn, Turn on her third album, which I was musical director on that. And then after we got the Birds together, I knew the song and somebody just reminded me of it. And I started playing it not the way Pete or Judy Collins had played it, but in a more rock and roll beat, like the Beatles. So that was the arrangement that came out. So it was a song I'd known for years.
Did it astound you? Did the success of the song astound you?
Well, we'd already had a number one hit with Mr. Tambourine Man, so we kind of started the genre folk rock, and we continued in that fashion with Turn, Turn, Turn. So I was happy to see it get the success it did, but I wasn't astounded because it was kind of following along the lines of Mr. Tambourine Man. I have to tell you, though, our manager didn't want that song to be the single. He wanted a Bob Dylan song to be the single. But Terry Melcher, Doris Day's son, who was our record producer at the time, took the single up and down the California coast, and he personally played it for every DJ in California, and it became a regional hit in California, and then it kind of spread across the country. So, yeah, it was slow in getting going, but I knew it was good.
David Cassini's got a question for you.
No, I was going to just make a comment, Alan, to you, Roger, that in Alan's interview with Pete, he mentions you by name and talks about the clang of the guitar and the way that you did it that made the song so unique. Did he ever talk to you about that?
That was the question.
Yes, I did talk to Pete. I became friendly with Pete. In fact, I went to his house several times and played with him, and I've been on stage with him, and I was at his 90th birthday party at Madison Square Garden and so on.
Sure.
He sent us a letter in 1965, maybe 66, after Turn, Turn, Turn had become a hit, and he said, "Dear Birds, I really loved the way you did Turn, Turn, Turn. I loved the clanging of the 12-string guitars. It sounded like bells." And he said, "My only musical query is why didn't you repeat the chorus?" And the reason for that was of time, because radio would only play something so many minutes long, and we couldn't extend it beyond that. So 3 minutes and 30 seconds was about the limit.
So Roger, tell us what if we ask you, is there a single thing that you will bring along with you in life that you remember about Pete?
Well, I remember his kindness and generosity. He was never really out to be a star or become rich and famous. He was always somebody who cared about people, and he was always a mentor personally to me. I mean, he sent me numerous letters explaining things and sent me musical things, ideas, and so on. And I just loved him as a kind of a fatherly figure, and I really appreciated everything he ever did.
Well, Roger McGuinn, we really thank you for giving us this time. It's terrific. Congratulations on everything you've done with your life. Thanks for helping us out with these memories. We appreciate it very much.
You're welcome. It was good talking to you.
Thank you, Roger.
Thank you.
Okay, that was Roger McGuinn, the Birds, it was terrific. And
Something else.
It never stops. There are so many people who owe so much to Pete.
And you've been hearing from so many people today, Alan.
We have. I mean, I can't even keep up with all the people I have to thank for writing me. So let's go to Carol in Sharon. All right, Carol, let's go. Is that a one? What is that? No, it's three.
Three.
Okay, Carol,
Caroline?
You're on.
This is Caroline Payton at Folk Legacy Records in Sharon, Connecticut. And I was one of the students that had the good fortune to hear Pete Seeger at Oberlin College.
Indeed.
In the early 50s. And then I remember before we moved to New England, my husband Sandy and I were at a fundraiser in Chicago when they were raising money for Pete's defense against the House Un-American Activities Committee. Mm-hmm. And he's been a lifelong inspiration to us and to people like us who have spent our lives involved with traditional music. When we moved to Sharon, Connecticut in 1967, Pete said to me, "You know, the woman that I learned how can I keep from singing from lives in Sharon, and I'm not sure, but I think she wrote the last verse." Because it is a Presbyterian hymn, I believe, and in some of the songbooks. Doris Plenn was from North Carolina, but none of the hymns in the hymn books have the verse about when tyrants tremble sick with fear.
Great verse.
And he said, "I really think Doris wrote it, but she never will admit it." So when we came to Sharon, we met Doris and her husband Abel, who ran a publishing company for Spanish books that they sold in Central America. But anyway, I realize I have known Pete Seeger for 65 years practically, and I remember something really touching about Toshi. One of the last times I saw her, which was quite a while ago, but she said to me, "You know, they got all this mail," which I can believe, because having a much smaller and less famous folk music company, we get a lot of mail to answer. And she said to me, you know, we are spending all of our time answering more and more and more mail. We try to, you know, answer every single postcard or letter that comes in. And she said, what a way to spend one's old age.
Well, I remember very well, you know, writing to Pete when I was 16 and getting letters back. Every time you wrote him a letter, you got something back exactly this way. And in fact, I remember something. Maybe you do, but apparently they didn't. Because I said, one time I wrote to you and to Toshi and Pete was there. And I said, and you sent me back a calendar with several different languages on the calendar, and wrote the note in the margin of the calendar. So they said, we don't remember that.
I think she ran out of scratch paper that day.
I don't know, but we were there. David Gustina and I were there, and we saw the mail on the table.
So they can't keep up with it.
Incredible.
Stacked up in piles, I'm sure.
What did you think of the house? It's so interesting because, you know, it's really two rooms. And Hudson Valley Magazine interviewed him, and they said to him, Pete said, I don't really believe anybody should live in more than two rooms. Well, they came with their whole troupe to the Mahaley Theater in Great Barrington, and there were 11 people, and we put them up in our house, which is an old Victorian. And I was a little ashamed, because when we put them up in this little suite we have upstairs, Toshi turned around to Pete and said, Peter, this is the house I always wanted so I could bring my relatives.
Well, you know, I'm embarrassed about this, too, because the reason we moved to Sharon is that we found a remodeled barn and carriage house, remodeled by someone else, thank God, but it had been turned into a music school for violinists in the late 1930s. And it was almost waiting for people like us who wanted to record music, put up friends and artists, and so on. And yet, you know, when you say that you have a 16-room house and one of the rooms is 50 by 30, I don't mean inches, but feet, people, luckily we don't heat, God knows we don't heat the whole thing because there's no water in one part of the house. And when we moved to Sharon, heating oil cost about 30 cents a gallon.
Yeah, we moved at pretty much the same time. Carolyn, we have to let everybody else have a chance. We thank you for
this. Can I say one final thought?
Of course, of course.
What I was thinking is, you know, we lived in England for a year. We knew Peggy Seeger and her husband, Ewan McCall, very well. And when Ewan died, I thought to myself, I'm so sorry he's gone, but he isn't really gone.
Exactly.
Because he had such a powerful effect on my life with his personality and his traditional songs and his original songs. I feel the same way about Pete. Yeah, yeah. He isn't really gone.
I agree with you, and it's one reason we can celebrate as well as feel sad today. You're exactly right. I think that's
He's
right.
He's still with us.
He is. Carolyn, thank you very much for calling. Okay. Let's go to Carl in Poughkeepsie. But before we do, Joe, you have something somebody just sent over the internet.
This is from Paul, who says, what I like most about Pete was that he was a very approachable person, unlike today's rock celebrities. I saw him at many venues and folk festivals where he always had a smile, and he was more than willing to stop and chat for a while. He was truly a man who walked the walk and did many great things. He will be missed. To everything there is a reason, sigh, the world is surely a sad place today.
That's great. Okay, let's go to Carl in Poughkeepsie. Carl, you're on.
Yes, my memory of Pete was as I sat waiting for a flight in O'Hare to come back to Newburgh, looking at the skyline of Chicago, an old fellow sat down next to me, and I said, quite a view. And he said, he turned his hearing aid, and he says, very deceptive. Then from there, we went on and bantered back and forth for 2 hours. And he asked what I did. I said, it's all printing presses. And I mentioned the name of the company, and years before it had made mimeograph machines. He said that thank God for them, because a lot of stuff made it out to the street that never would have without them.
Exactly.
But then I mentioned to him that I loved his Hudson River music, but I had an animosity for the Hudson River since I went onto the ice on 112th Street Bridge in Troy when I was a kid. at that point, he said he had a grandmother and grandfather in Troy. His grandfather worked at the coking works of the steel mill in South Troy. And one morning at breakfast, his grandmother told him not to go into work because she had a very bad dream. Well, he went into work, and it was a tremendous explosion in the coking mill, and the only thing that came back from work was his grandfather's ring finger with the ring on it.
Oh, boy.
He had a grandfather in Troy who worked at the steel mill, the Bird and Iron Works.
Interesting. Well, Carl, thank you. It's a great...
Well, that would explain his want for unionization. A lot of what we talked about for 2 hours was unionization and how salespeople didn't have a prayer to do it.
Yeah. Thank you,
Carl.
Well,
anyway, I met him once, but other time, at when he started the Clearwater, and he started a concert a little early in Poughkeepsie. And he said, he quoted Christ in the Sermon on the Mount, but that's why he started early. But it was always a pleasure to meet the man.
And always a pleasure to hear from you, Carl. Call again. Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye.
Okay, and now we're going to go to Tim. Okay, Tim, you're on.
Hello, Alan.
Hello.
And first of all, let me offer my condolences to you, because it's like, for you, you lost like a family member today.
Without question, but I really believe I'm not alone in that. I think so many of us are in that because there are so many of us who feel so close to this man. When somebody called from Oberlin College, I keep thinking about my very good friend and bandmate, Joe Brody. And I remember when Oberlin was among the first to bring him out, and that was the only way he could survive during the blacklist. So people have very close attachments. But go ahead, Tim.
No, my mother said she felt like she lost a part of herself today.
Absolutely.
She and my father, when they got married back in 1952, they had intended fully to have the Weavers sing at their wedding. Until my Hungarian grandmother got a hold of that idea.
Well, but, it's fascinating. It's fascinating stuff.
Yeah, because they used to hang out in with the union halls and see Pete sing. And 20 years ago, when I was involved with Walkabout Clearwater, I was bringing something back to Pete's house, and my parents were driving, and dropped it off. And Pete invited us for dinner. And I used to play with Pete's music with Pete regularly, and I don't know how Toshi was thrilled about that, but we had dinner with him, and it was just absolutely wonderful. It was just magic to be included in that.
And that's the way they were. And
when 100%, yeah. Yeah.
And when David and I were up there, she couldn't do enough.
She made us muffins. Yeah. It was unbelievable.
Hey, Tim, we got to go. We've got a very special guest on the line, as well as your being a very special guest.
Oh, I wanted to add one extra thing. Could I hold?
No, go ahead. Do it real fast.
Okay. Last month, in November, I played with him again 20 years after not having played with him.
Yep.
At Manitou Green was running in Ulster County for the legislature,
right.
And Pete was... And anyway, I played bass the whole concert, and my four young kids, who were 8, 6, 5, and 4, were dancing up in front, and Manna said, "Put the kids up front. Pete loves kids." And we got our picture taken with Pete, who was absolutely their hero, not for all the reasons mentioned, because he was the man who sings Cock-a-Doodle-Doo.
Indeed he does, and those wonderful pictures. And by the way, well, never mind, but we'll see those pictures during our fun drive. Then thank you so much, Tim. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, we're gonna be talking now with banjo great Tony Trischka, who is, there's just really no one better. He plays the five string. And has defined modern bluegrass. Tony, thank you so much for joining us. And I know that you have played with Pete. I know we saw you at his birthday party. So what is it that you can relate to for us about Pete?
Well, as I think anyone who's ever come across Pete and has spent any time with him, there's so many stories to tell. I mean, it's obviously just a great loss to the world at large, because he made such a contribution on so many different levels, you know, morally, ethically, musically. But, you know, one thing I'd like to talk about is just music was pouring out of him at all times.
Yep.
I had this experience. I was playing at the Winnipeg Folk Festival up in Canada, and Pete was on the bill also. He was one of the performers. And I had to go back to the airport at the end of the weekend, and I got on this bus that was taking performers back. And I get on the bus, and it's just Pete there, sitting in the front seat right by the driver. And I sat down behind him, and he said, "You know, Tony, audiences these days don't know how to sing the bass parts of sing-alongs. You know, the song Down by the Riverside?" And I said, "Sure, Pete, yeah. I listened to your records growing up. Sure, I know." And he said, "Well, why don't you sing it, and I'll demonstrate what I'm talking about." And so as soon as I walk on the bus, I'm doing a sing-along with Pete. And I start singing it, and he starts singing the bass part.
Hmm.
And then as soon as we got to the airport, we're getting in line to go through customs, and the line's not moving. And they're like 6 or 7 big, long lines. And he's in a line next to me, and we're talking a little bit, and, you know, then I would just kind of space out a little bit because they're just in this long line. And then we talk some more, and we had our banjos with us. And at one point I look over, and he's kneeling down to take his banjo out of the case. And I'm thinking, this is pretty amazing, because there was a lot of business folks going down to the States, a lot of people in suits and ties and, you know, fairly well-dressed folks. And here Pete and me in jeans and, you know, looking kind of folky. And anyway, so Pete takes out his banjo, stands up, and starts playing a tune. And you can just sense, you know, I mean, I think some people are enjoying it, and other people are thinking, who's this person? This is antisocial behavior, if ever there was some. And he didn't care. He just wanted to play the banjo. So I took my banjo. I wasn't going to miss the opportunity, and took the banjo and started playing with him. And that's how we passed the time in line. I mean, just an example, you know, he couldn't repress that music. It just had to come out of him.
And he was a pretty good instrumentalist. You know, some people put him down, they compare him to you or to other people who are tremendous technicians. But if you listen to the early stuff and to some of the later stuff, he was pretty good.
He was an extraordinary banjo player. You know, when I do some solo shows, I always try to point that out to people. And I'll start by saying, you know, most people think about Pete as just doing the strumming thing.
Yeah.
And I'll get everyone to sing along with one chorus of this little light of mine, and I just kind of strum along. And there's even an art to strumming. You know, it's not like you just do that. He really had an art to the way he did strumming. And then he came up with something called the basic strum, which I think is based on clawhammer and other old-time styles. But if you listen to his album Goofing Off Suite, which he recorded for Folkways in 1955, there's a song on there called Blue Skies. And it's just ridiculous how amazingly difficult and technically advanced that is. He was way ahead of his time.
And of course, Tony, he introduced all of us who then played the banjo or tried to with how to play the 5-string banjo. And so many people learned it. One would, you know, I mean, there was the Scruggsian end of things in terms of bluegrass. And then there was, you know, the Pete folk way of doing it. And I suspect we wouldn't have had folk music in America without Pete. Is that too much of a generalization?
It's a little hard to say, but, excuse me, he did so much. You know, you can point to the Lomaxes as bringing folk music to the people, and his own father and mother, Charles and Ruth Crawford Seeger, I guess is...
Yeah, but he was the one who popularized all of that.
Between, you know, what he did as a solo performer and the Weavers, for instance, of course, who got very large in the late 40s and into the early 50s before the McCarthy folks stomped out their career. But, yeah, and they introduced a lot of people to Woody Guthrie and to Lead Belly and people like that. Sure. So, yeah, I mean, Pete obviously was in the huge vanguard of bringing folk music to the people. Dave Gard of the Kingston Trio learned to play the banjo in Pete's banjo book. He always cites that. He would cite that. And the Kingston Trio, you know, were sort of the spawn of Pete Seeger. So both directly and indirectly, he had such an influence.
And I think Peter, Paul, and Mary, when you think about it, I mean, some of the greatest...
Oh, you can go on and on and on. Yeah, Brothers Sword, Limelighters, Peter, Paul, and Mary, Joan Baez, you know, Bob Dylan. I mean, the list is endless.
It is. Hey, Tony, thank you for joining us. We've got all these people on the line who want to talk about their memories, and everybody has a memory of Pete Wynn. And Tony, thank you so much for giving us this time.
Thank you. My pleasure. Okay. I really appreciate it. Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so now we have to go to... like, this reflections are not that good. Greg in. Okay, Greg, your turn. Greg, you're on.
Yeah. Hi, Alan.
Hey.
I can mention times I heard him in Oberlin, too, but actually much more recently, I really found out what Pete was all about. Should have realized it all along. What he was really all about was Tease. Well, I'll tell you, the anecdote that brought this out for me, about 10 years ago, we had the Iraq War, anti-Iraq War protests, you know, and they were quite a few places in our area. I'm from Rhinebeck. Well, we got a call from someone named Pete Seeger that wanted us to join him in Wappingers for side the road there, 9 and 9D, for a peace demonstration or against the war. So we all got there and unfurled the banners and so forth and had our signs and so forth, had nice conversations with Pete. But across the intersection, catty corner across this very large intersection, the pro-war people gathered, you know, with their flags and so forth and their signs. And you could feel, you know, even across that, the hostility, the vibes, you know, going back and forth. There wasn't shouting, but there were looks exchanged and so forth. Well, before we knew it, here is this elderly gentleman waiting for the light and then striding across purposefully to the other side, and we were wondering, now what is Pete doing? Pretty soon he's over there talking with them all, talking with them one by one, I should say, and engaged in apparently very amicable conversations, and there was really nothing bad going on there whatsoever, whereas we thought if some of us went over there might be arguments or even worse, you know. Mm. So after a while, he came back, and we asked him, well, what was this, what were you talking about, you know, and just apparently we're discussing and talking about the issues, and in an amicable way, and when it was all done, then there was a certain calming effect there, and Pete said that he told them, now isn't this great that we can talk like this about having such different points of view on the same issue? Doesn't this just go to show what a great country we really live in?
And you're a great guy to make the call, Greg, because we want to give everybody a chance, and we thank you so much. It's a great story, by the way. I love that story.
Thank you, Alan.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Bye.
Okay, and let's go to Hattie in Athol, Mass. Okay, Hattie, you're on.
Hi there. I'm from Athol.
Yeah.
I was on a peace walk through the area where Pete lives, going down to New York, and he joined the walk for the day. It was about 7, 8, 9 years ago. And he turned to me. I was beating a prayer drum. And he said, oh, gee, I forgot my plastic bag. And I said, well, I have an extra plastic bag right here. And I handed him, you know, a little plastic bag I had, a little kind of one that you might take to the supermarket or something. Anyway, and he, oh, thank you so much. Now I can do what I love to do best in the world. And he was hopping around, picking up all the trash on the road.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, and he was having the time of his life, like a little kid. Oh, look at this one. I got this one. I got that one. He totally enjoyed picking up trash.
Well,
that's my story.
That's what he did, and it's a great story. Hattie, thank you for the call. Appreciate
it. Sure. Thank you.
Okay, let's go to Sarah in Shelburne. Okay, Sarah, your turn. Sarah.
Yes.
Your turn.
You got to turn your radio down, Sarah.
Rule number one for everybody, not only for Sarah, but for everybody, is when you're on the phone, there's a delay, so you have to turn down the radio when you're talking on the phone.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, tonight here in Western Massachusetts, we're going to have a hootenanny for Pete.
Oh, great.
And first met him when he started the People's Music Network with Charlie King back in 1977. And what I remember is that he used to be able to, he'd put his name in the hat along with everybody else for the round robins.
Oh, so it was his turn came up every once in a while.
Yeah, but he didn't, instead of being featured, he wanted to be part of the group. So my son remembers him as the person who liked to sit with the young people and eat chili together.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 86, when Ruth Pelham from Albany and a group of us started the Children's Music Network, Pete thought of it as a sanctuary, a place to relax where no one would put pressure on him. And what Paul Stuckey was saying about being allergic to compliments, he could just be himself. And what I remember is him just really leaning into life and just giving everybody a sense of that our music mattered. He told us that we used to be a singing nation, and it just would encourage us to not give up our work, which is we do peace and social justice music with children.
He loved Ruth Pelham, by the way.
Yes.
Great favorite here. But in addition, I saw him do something one day, Hattie, which was fascinating, and that was, you know, he was not a guy who was given to getting mad. However, I saw him angry one day because I don't remember what the venue was. It was in a school or something like that, and they had put out a flyer, and on the flyer it had Pete Seeger in big letters on the top, and underneath it it had all the other performers who were performing there.
Yes.
And he got angry because because he said that wasn't the deal. The deal was everybody got the same attention that I do. So I thought that was interesting, and I've seen him do it in a number of ways like that. So that's something.
That's exactly how we're setting up the Hootenanny tonight.
That's
that
great.
It's everybody who wants to sing gets a chance, all ages, everybody.
And where is it?
It's going to be at the Ashfield Congregational Church at 7 p.m. Ashfield is in Western Mass.
Oh, indeed it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Hattie, thanks for the call. Appreciate it very much.
Sarah.
Sarah.
Sarah Pirtle.
Oh, Sarah. I'm so sorry, Sarah. So sorry.
I'm so glad to get to speak because he's made a difference in my life since I was 12.
You bet. That's why we're doing it. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, I seem to be messing up here, which is not all. So, well, let's go to Aldo in Chatham. Okay, Aldo, you're on.
Hi. Greetings, Alan. Greetings, Joe.
Hi.
Thanks for doing the program, and also thanks for the interview this morning, for replaying that. It was wonderful to hear. Yeah, I wanted to share a short story that happened. I think it was 2005. I was at a alternative currency conference that was held at Bard College, mm-hmm. and Pete was there, and I'd never met him. And he was, you know, he's been a hero of my grandfather and also my father, and so I knew about him. And I play the fiddle a little bit, and I saw him walking up the path. And he didn't know me, you know, from anyone. And he came towards me, and I had my fiddle in my hand, and I introduced myself to him. And I kind of boldly, I just said, Pete, would it be all right if I played a little bit with you on stage tonight? I guess it was a little bold, but I thought, why not? And he looked at me, and he looked down, and he said, well, are you any good? And I said, well, some people think I'm all right. And he said, well, let's hear you. And right there on the side, on the lawn there at Bard, he took out his, it was a 12-string guitar, and I took out my fiddle, and he's like, Joel, just start playing something. And I started playing, and he just started playing along with me. And people gathered, people sat around and listened, and there's 30 people there, like, listening in 5 minutes. But and I did. He called me up on stage, and I played one tune with him. And it's just remarkable, out of all the things that, you know, we speak about Pete Seeger, that kind of career and life and reputation does not alienate him from a young 26-year-old mm-hmm. guy that just wants to join him. Like, his arms were open, his mind was open. To me,
that's Pete.
So many people.
Yeah, that's Pete, all right, Aldo. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, Aldo, because there are so many people who want to have a say, let me say thank you for the call and for the great story. It really was a great story. Nice. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
Yeah. Let's go to Nick in Greenfield. Nick, you're on.
Hello, Alan.
Hey, Nick.
About 1981, I was among the volunteer musicians on the Clearwater playing for the annual pumpkin sale. And we played concerts up and down the river in Beacon and various places, and Ben Pete was always there playing. And one night, we were playing in what was then the Rhinecliff Hotel. I guess it's a fancy place now, but at the time, it was a seedy little joint on the side of the hill.
Yeah.
And a little dive bar kind of thing, and I guess that was the only location big enough to you know put all of us playing music, and they had a microphone and stuff. So we were all stuffed on the stage of the bar in the corner at the Rhinecliff Hotel one night, and there was like one microphone or something, and we were playing a variety of stuff. And at one point, we were playing something that was maybe like a pretty straightforward, like a 12-bar blues or something. It was kind of wide open musically and melodically. And I just remember one time in the middle of it, Pete took a banjo break. And I was listening to Tony Trischka a minute ago. He was a wonderful, wonderful player. And I just remember Pete stepping up to the mic with his long-neck banjo, you know, and in the middle of this 12-bar blues, he just took the most wonderful, interesting, melodic, soulful banjo, but way up on the neck of his banjo. You know, he just knew the neighborhood up there, and it was the Pete Seeger that a few of us who got a chance to stand on the stage with him at some point, you know, even for a fleeting moment, we got to experience that part of Pete, you know, which is the part that not everybody was fortunate enough to experience. And it was something else. I was just knocked out because I, you know, for decades, it's all the other Pete you hear about.
Sure. And what key were you playing in?
Well, I don't know. It might have been E, which is usually not much fun on the banjo, you know?
Well, no, except that's why he invented, basically, the long-neck banjo.
Well, right, and I remember, I have a copy of his banjo book from, you know, like, 1962 or something, yeah. And somewhere, you know, on page 23, he says, you know, all you do is you just saw off the neck of your banjo.
Yeah.
And I think when you saw off the neck of your banjo.
That's exactly right. He taught you how to do it.
And, he just, great, you know, so. God bless him. He did what he had to do to get the job done.
Yeah, and that's so good that you remember. It was a trick question, of course. I wanted you to say, I don't remember, but you said E, and that's exactly right, because no capo and 3 frets larger, and you're an E.
Yeah, and of course, that's the if you're kicking a blues tune around, most musicians will favor that key because first of all, because it's easy on the guitar, right?
Yeah, sure.
And but it's hell for leather on the banjo, that's for sure.
And by the way, even with the 3rd fret, it is still hell for leather. Hey, Nick, thanks for the great call. Appreciate
thanks
it.
Thanks for all you're doing, Alan.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
And okay, let's go to Jonathan and Troy. Okay, Jonathan, it's got to be short because we're gonna have to take a break at exactly 1:59. Go ahead.
Well, thanks, Alan. This is a nice short one. It's one of my earliest memories growing up in the Bronx. And
uh-huh.
The first record that I always wanted to play, I probably drove my parents crazy with it, was Pete Seeger's Children Concert at Town Hall. I have it to this day. I found it on iTunes, and I have the full concert now, and I absolutely
isn't
love
that,
it.
Isn't that great?
Great?
You know, when I worked at Camp Bronx House in Copaic, New York, they had one record, and that record was Pop Goes the Weasel on the banjo. It was 70. It was 78, and it was Pete. I've been looking for that record for a long time. That was his banjo technique was fabulous, Jonathan, fabulous.
Yes.
Yeah, that's great, and thanks for the memory. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Alan.
So, Joe Donahue, what do you make of all of this?
It's very exciting. We're hearing from everybody, and we welcome your phone calls at 1-800-348-2551.
Your first concert, your mom took you to a Pete Seeger concert, wasn't it?
My first album. The first album I ever had was a Pete Seeger, was the Pete Seeger Children's album, was the first album I ever had. And that was the first one that I put on that. It was a Snoopy
phonograph.
Yeah. And then and the first time I met him was here in Albany at a Jesse Jackson rally that I was covering in 1984.
Wow. How about you, David Gustina?
I just have been honored to even have not only come to work for WAMC.
He liked you. He really liked you.
Well, I loved him. I don't know how you could not love him. I mean, Alan, I just remember being down there that day and not only watching you, someone who I know is just your hero, and I've never seen you really nervous about anything, and I know you were nervous that day.
A little nervous.
And at the same time, Pat Cooney and I sitting there watching this interview unfold, we were shaking at the end. We really could feel his power and to tell those stories and to hear that history that he's able to bring. And then your questions just dropped in perfectly in each spot.
He asked me after that. I said, "What'd you think?" And he said, "Well, how come you were so quiet?" I said, "I was scared."
Right. But you knew everything. So you knew everything about him.
Well, no, I did. I knew a lot about him because of my hero. Okay, we got to take a break.